Thank you for downloading this edition of The Why Factor, a programme that asks why we do the things we do.
Hi. Hope you don't mind me asking, but what do you do?
What do you do?
What do you do?
Hi, so what do you do?
What do you do? How many times have you been asked that question, or have asked it yourself? So what do you do? Why do we ask, what do you do? After all, there are so many other things we could be talking about. So what do you do? Me? I'm David Baker, and I'm presenting this week's episode of The Why Factor on the BBC World Service.
The way Richard and I met meant that we didn't ask each other what we did for quite a long time.
This is Sonia. She and her partner Richard have a very special relationship with that question, what do you do?
We met at the School of Life at an evening entitled How to Have Better Conversations. During the course of that evening, they spoke about how people always ask each other what they do, usually at the beginning of a conversation, at a party or whatever, and they said that that's a very boring way to start a conversation and there are much more interesting ways to engage with someone. So at the end of the evening, Richard and I went out for a drink together and decided that we wouldn't tell each other what we did.
So what did you talk about, Richard, on that first evening?
There were so many things when you start thinking about it, actually, almost the last thing you need to ask is what you actually do. Obviously, we were talking about the dynamics of conversations and how to make those more fulfilling and interesting.
We, of course, that night that we met, didn't know anything about whether we'd see each other again or anything like that. But when we did meet again, it came up, are we going to tell each other what we do? It was nearly 8 months before we told each other.
We'll hear more from Sonia and Richard later in the programme. But why do we believe that our jobs are the most profound thing about us? When we ask that question, what do you do, are we really opening up the opportunity for the other person to boast about their work? Or is there something deeper going on? Obviously, it's a simple social convention. But it's one that I've been struggling with for a long time. Because although I've introduced myself to you as the presenter of this programme, a lot of the time I find the question a bit awkward. I don't really like to give a precise answer. Perhaps because I do a lot of different things. So why do people ask, what do you do? Well, first up, isn't it just an easy way to break the ice? Meet Nicola Klasser. Her job involves a lot of ice breaking.
I think it's a very good way of opening a conversation.
So what does Nicola do?
I'm a Swedish diplomat and served as a Swedish ambassador to the UK for 6 years.
An ambassador? That's one of those jobs, isn't it? Who wouldn't be impressed?
People might ask me what I do, and when I served as ambassador, I might say I'm at the Swedish embassy. And then, of course, people would try to figure out what position you have at the embassy, and they'd start by saying, so what responsibility would you have? And then you say, well, pretty much everything. And then they get even more confused, and then gradually they realise, so you're the ambassador.
Why is this question part of our identity? Why do we ask people what they do? I mean, there's plenty of other things that we could ask about someone.
I think people in general are quite curious about other people, but I wouldn't say that it always works. I mean, to ask people what they're doing for a living, because not everyone wants to talk about it, especially not at social events. Some people might really want to talk about other things like traffic, politics, weather. So it's not always a conversation opener, and at times it also feels a bit awkward to ask people what they do for a living.
But even for an ambassador who's an expert at breaking the ice, sometimes that question doesn't work at all.
The worst thing that can happen is if you start a conversation and you serve the ball, the other person smashes, and then you quickly run out of balls, and then you have to move on to someone else to talk to. That has occasionally happened. You know, they reply with one word, and you just don't get anywhere.
Oof. We all know how that feels. So asking what people do is a good way, usually, of getting the conversation going. But there's a deeper side too.
The identity we have with our job goes fairly deep, particularly for men, less so for women.
And what do you do?
I'm Professor Kerry Cooper, Professor of Organizational Psychology and Health at the Alliance Manchester Business School, the University of Manchester. We collect a lot of information from people we call nonverbal behavior, what they're wearing, their stature, their nonverbal forms of communication. But we also want to find out what job they do. That enables us to kind of, in a sense, I hate saying this, but pigeonhole them, stereotyping them, so that we can determine what kind of relationship we want to have with them. So if you say to somebody, what do you do? And they say something which is not linked to the job you're doing, say you meet them in a social context.
Hi, so what do you do?
Then you'll say to yourself, well, maybe I'll just look at this person on a personal level. Do I like them? Would I like to establish a relationship with them? If, on the other hand, you discover they could be a potential customer, client, supplier, who knows what, because they're kind of linked in a way to your role, that becomes different. So you now found that out, and that means you now determine what kind of relationship you want to have. Is it going to be a business relationship, a personal relationship, or some other kind of relationship?
And that relationship has a lot to do with status.
It is important in society, because society, particularly in the workplace, it's all to some extent about your stature, where you are in the social pecking order or the workplace pecking order. It's quite important for people. It makes them feel valued, significant in terms of other people's eyes. And so it's quite central.
But if our job is so much part of our identity, what happens when we lose it?
I'm Kelvin Whitwell, planning and project engineer for the North Yorkshire Motor Railway.
He's an engineer who worked for 20 years in the steelworks in Redcar in the north of England until it was closed down and he lost his job. Today, he's working once more as an engineer. But first, here's what being a steel man meant to him.
I was a fitter in engineering. I was on the steel industry. That was my upbringing. It gave me 20 years of my life. And if you cut me in half at the point, I would have a steel worker inside me.
Wow, what an image. You can really feel how important being a steelworker was for Kelvin. And more than that, it's been part of his family's identity for a long time too.
Running through my family, I was a seventh generation steelworker. My mother's done the family history way back to whenever. My father worked in the chemical industry most of his life, but he did come and work for me in the workshops. So we classed him as a steelworker because he'd worked on the steelworks. My granddad was a blast furnace foreman at Skinning Grove. Like you say, seventh generation.
Like Kelvin, the entire town took its identity from steelmaking.
The area around here, I live in Saltburn, 6 miles from the site, Redcar, Grangetown, Southbank, they were all built around the steelworks. Going back years ago, there was 100,000 people employed in the steel industry. Now, not so many.
But then steel went the way of so many of the UK's traditional industries, and the works closed down.
When I was made redundant, I was gutted. The steelworks was all I've known my entire working life, 20 years on the steelworks. Hadn't done anything job-wise outside of that. The Monday, Tuesday, when it sank in, it was like, right, now what do I do? Yeah, the money side of it was important because I've got a family and all our savings went in the few months I was redundant. I felt lost.
If you lose your job, as happened to Kelvin, a whole part of your identity is at risk. So though it's nice to identify yourself by your job, there are pitfalls.
It's very difficult for people who lose a job, title of CEO or professor or something like that, because that's part and parcel of their identity, and they have real trouble with it. But if work is very important to you and your sense of achievement and sense of purpose and everything else is linked to your work, to lose a job title is very significant.
So how can you avoid that trap? Well, one way is not to ask at all, which is what Sonia and Richard chose to do when they first met. But that can't last forever. Eventually, they were going to have to spill the beans.
Richard was going to be attending a conference in London. I invited him to come and stay with me while he was in London. We then decided, well, instead of just letting it maybe slip out in some way, we'd make a decision that, OK, now we're going to tell each other. So Richard called it the grand reveal. He said that he wanted to show me what he did rather than tell me. And so we had this day where he picked me up in London early in the morning and drove me out into the countryside, and I didn't know what we were doing or where we were going or what it was all about. One of the fun things we did was leading up to the grand reveal, just before that, we agreed that we would each separately make a list of clues we'd picked up on about what the other person might do, and followed at the end of it with a guess about what we thought it might be. So things, for example, that, you know, I'd picked up from Richard that he travels around a lot and that he has clients. And he picked up that I was quite punctual, you know, that my work involved sort of sticking to a time schedule. So they're just sort of little things like that that we picked up on from each other. And so we did this thing of making a list and then having a guess.
Did you then guess each other's jobs from the list? Or?
Well, it was quite interesting because Sonia had gone to a wedding in South Africa and she was having an evening with a friend and they were sort of trying to guess what I actually did. So I think I was quite horrified at some of the job suggestions.
Do you remember what came up?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. She's an old university friend of mine. And we had this whole fun conversation. And she's very imaginative. And she came up with all sorts of things like, oh, so he's got clients and he travels. Maybe he repairs bells in parish churches in little villages. Or
I was even an undertaker, I think.
Yeah, so that was... Oh, and another fun conversation we had was what might be a deal breaker. So if I found out that he did X job, would I be horrified? Yours for me was an undertaker, wasn't it?
It was interesting. I don't think the more we got to know each other, the more I thought, well, there actually isn't any job that could be a deal breaker, because I think at that point we got to know each other well enough that it was almost irrelevant.
What Sonia and Richard discovered is that what we do for work is just such a tiny part of our identity. And it's getting to this stage of awareness that Fiona Buckland is especially interested in. She's a life coach and helps people with their careers, which means a lot more than just finding people jobs to apply for.
So I work with people who come to me because they feel a little stuck somewhere in their lives. And it might be very often people are showing up and going, I need to change my job. I don't like where I work. I don't like my job title. I want to find a job title that will suit me, you know, that will reflect my inner to the outer world. The other thing that happens, of course, is that I have people come to me saying, I have the most amazing job. Why do I feel so empty?
What role does our work have in how we see ourselves, how we see our identity?
In our culture, absolutely huge. It's not just engaged in how much time we spend there, which we do, but very much engaged in who we think we are. And it's formulated fairly early on, I think. Very often we make decisions about our work and our job titles and where we want to be and what we're aspiring to quite early on in our early 20s. And we might find later on that that shifts and changes in ways that we didn't expect then, because you can't imagine in your early 20s how you're going to feel in your late 30s. And that's a really interesting point to come to.
I wonder if it even starts earlier than that.
We ask kids at a very early age, what do you want to be when you grow up? So what we're doing very early on is we're merging the job title with who they are. I want to be a fireman, I want to be a nurse, I want to be an innovator, I want to... whatever it might be. And I think that sticks a little bit. And what my job is, part of the techniques that I use as a coach, is to try and tease those separately. You know, what's the being? Who do you want to be? And then what do you want to do?
There it is again, separating what we do from who we are, something Sonia and Richard really embraced. So how did it go when they finally got to that grand reveal day and asked each other, so what do you do?
So there was this point where he stopped the car really in the middle of nowhere and opened the door and said, let's get out here. And we did. And he said, this is my office. And it was just this massive field. And I was very, very bewildered, and I just didn't know what he was on about. And then I kind of said, well, what is this? And he then said his job title is an agronomist, which I'd never, ever heard of before. So it was very interesting for me to discover what that was.
To clarify for anyone who's listening to this who hasn't had Sonia's head start, could you explain exactly what an agronomist is?
Well, it's quite fun because everybody always asks that question. And basically, I work with landowners and I advise them on everything from the way they grow their crops through to the way that they manage their estate. And that involves the physical and the financial. So for me, there's sort of the stereotypical what an agronomist does, and we actually sort of physically showed that. But also, so much of what I do is about change management. And I think there's lots of similarities and the sort of parallels in terms of, for me, it's as much about the psychology of dealing with people. And I think that's quite interesting again.
Yeah, that was a big overlap for us because my work is all about psychology and people. And so although our fields are quite different, there's this huge overlap where we're both fascinated by how people do things and change management and all that sort of thing. So yeah, that was really interesting.
But along the way, you'd been picking up certain clues. She seemed to be punctual. Any other clues?
Well, I think one of the most significant for me was we met in sort of Sonia's environment.
He met me at my office, which is in Harley Street, and that's obviously very associated with medicine. And when he came into my office, he said that he noticed there wasn't any medical paraphernalia around and there wasn't any medical smell. And he started thinking that it's something to do with psychology or therapy or something like that. So his guess for what I did was he put a few titles down, you know, is it psychiatrist or psychotherapist or what is it? He didn't actually guess the exact word, but he sort of thought it was somewhere in the ballpark and he was quite right.
And to take us all off our tenterhooks, what is it actually that you do, Sonia?
Well, I am a psychotherapist and I also lecture in psychotherapy.
There's one more response to the question, what do you do, that really intrigues me. The reluctant answer. As Swedish ambassador, Nicola had a particularly interesting case of a reluctant what do you do-ness.
We would invite the Nobel Prize laureates to the embassy for a lunch, and you happen to have quite a few Nobel Prize laureates. And when you had to explain what made them win the prize, that was the nightmare, because quite often it was so esoteric that even if they tried to really make it very simple, that was tough.
What do you think those people say to people at parties when they say, what do you do?
Well, I do recall one such situation with the Nobel Prize laureate, Peter Higgs, who won the prize a few years back. And of course, he was so humble that it was just incredible. And he definitely downplayed his role, almost apologising for winning the Nobel Prize.
The opposite of the humble laureate is the holder of the boastful job title. And Fiona Buckland says people often come to see her because they have a particular job title in mind.
People just want to be recognised. They want to be acknowledged. They want to feel progress. So director of, guru of, head of, chief, pleasure officer, joy officer.
We have a lot of strange new titles, you know, chief happiness officer. And part of that is the organisation trying to create an image of itself. We're unique. We're a happy company to work for.
Chief, pleasure officer, joy officer, minister for fun.
We don't have the normal IT exec. We have stormtroopers. That's not the individual doing that. That's the organization thinking it's great to project that image.
Chief hilarity officer, chief ethics officer. And I quite like that one myself, I have to say. Chief emotional management officer. Chief self-awareness guru.
They're really funny, these job titles. At a technology conference once, I met someone whose job title was Deputy Monkey, and I still don't know what they do. And I quite fancy being a guru. But there's a serious point here. All this trumpeting our job titles hides a lot of all the rest of the stuff that we are. What we like to do in our spare time, where we live, what our dreams are even. All of those are important parts of our identity, and they're often way more interesting than what we do at work. And they lead to better conversations, as Sonia and Richard have found.
The whole theme of all the conversations we've been having was how do we keep having good conversations as the relationship develops? And so we were very conscious of keeping that balance between the amount you talk about work and the amount you talk about other things. And there is that sort of knee-jerk reaction when you get home at the end of a day, you immediately want to start talking about work. And so it was how to manage that dynamic.
That was a really important thing because the whole way it began was about being experimental and open-minded and playful and exploratory and keeping that going when you do know more of the details. You, like Richard says, you can easily fall just into habits of just talking about the things you know about.
It's such a simple thing, but it's really changed interactions I have with people.
Would you like to see the end of that question in social discourse?
Absolutely.
Well, I think it's a safety blanket. People go straight for that as a way of trying to get information that will make them feel more secure about whether they feel they can relate to that person or whether they'll have anything in common or are they in a similar league to each other or not. And Richard was saying that one of the things that people do in asking what another person does also is sort of a bit ruthless, because it's a bit like, are you going to be of use to me? And there's all that sort of stuff that people do at parties, which is quite ugly in a way. And I think it's a challenge to step aside from that and see if people are actually interested in connecting with another human being without knowing whether they're going to be somebody important or earning a lot of money or not, or whatever.
It's a lovely idea, and it works for them. You can see that Sonia and Richard really know about each other in a deep way. And they're still very much in love. When they came into the studio, they were holding hands. And that's not something you see very often at the BBC. If you can get past just talking about someone's job, you can find out really interesting things about them. And sometimes asking what do you do is just a way to test the water. Fiona Buckland.
Quite often what we ask people is what we would want to be asked, but it's clearing our throats a bit, isn't it, before we step into perhaps the deeper question. What I notice about people is they ask that and then step away or say another question. It's the follow-up question that's interesting, isn't it? Oh, that's really interesting. But why not say that? What makes you most proud about that? What do you love most about that? Rather than doing that part of going, that sounds really interesting. Is that based in London? What's the commute like? That kind of question. What makes you feel a greater sense of achievement? What makes you feel most fulfilled? How is that about you and not just about what society expects of us?
Thank you for listening to The Why Factor. I'm David Baker, and the producer was Phil Reevil. If you've enjoyed this edition, you may be interested in others such as Thankless Tasks or Complexity. You'll find those and many more on the website. And we'd love to hear your views on the programme and your ideas for future topics. You can reach us at yfactor@bbc.com. One final thought. The thing about job identity is that it can be reshaped, as Kelvin, the former steelworker, has found out in his new role.
It's about 12 foot high. The engine will be weighing somewhere 60, 70 tonne. LMS engine built in 1944 in Derby.
What I'm employed here for is as a planning and project engineer. I've been here 18 months. A lot of people get excited when they say, they ask me, where do you work? I work on the North Yorkshire Moors Railway, the Heritage Railway, and it's a popular place, so I'm privileged to be here. And my identity at the moment is engineer. I'm loving it, to be honest.